As we begin this video, I'd like to remind everyone that our YouTube channel, See Answers TV, has an entire playlist dealing with the Islamic religion. Please go there to find out more about that. And we also have a website, www.MuslimHope.com, which also deals with the Islamic religion from a Christian point of view. I wish to thank Dr. Bill Warner for giving us permission to post his videos on our YouTube channel, See Answers TV. I would urge viewers to check out his website, www.politicalislam.com, and many of the other videos he has produced concerning the threat of Islam to Western civilization on YouTube. Dr. Warner makes complicated subjects surprisingly easy to understand, as you will see in this video presentation. The 1,400-year-old history of the spread of Islam is not widely known. Historically, few people know that the Muslims were involved in 548 offensive battles against non-Muslim cultures, as this video will reveal. As you can see here, I'm going to mention these battles from an excellent book called 100 Battles, Decisive Conflicts That Shaped the World, published by Paragon Publishers, 2012. First, notice the Battle of Tours or Poitiers in 732 CE on page 44. The Battle of Tours-Poitiers was a turning point in world history, one that affected the cultural development of Western Europe. It was here that the tide of Muslim conquest was turned back, with enormous long-term implications for the future of European Christendom. And I'll leave it to the viewers at home. If they need to pause the video here, they can read some of the information that's posted right here for you to see on your screen. I will read a little bit of the last page here, the last column on the second page. Meanwhile, some of Martel's scouts had managed to get into the Moorish, Moorish is another way of saying Muslim, camp during the battle, taking advantage of overconfidence on the part of the enemy. There they freed prisoners and generally caused mayhem. This confusion in their rear, coupled with the worry that their hard-won plunder might be stolen back by the Franks, drew many of Rahman's troops back to the camp and severely disrupted the attack on the Frank square. Rahman tried to stop the rearward movement, but in so doing exposed himself with an inadequate bodyguard. He was killed by Frankish soldiers. The Moors were dismayed, and they withdrew from the battlefield in some disorder, the Franks choosing not to pursue despite still retaining considerable power. The Battle of Tours-Poitiers has at times been lauded as the only reason Europe is not a Muslim state and a part of the Arab Empire. While this is an exaggeration, it is fair to say that Charles deserved the Hammer nickname, which was conferred on him for handling the Muslim expansion such a dramatic defeat. Expeditions over the Pyrenees would continue, and Charles Martel would oppose them for the rest of his life. The Muslim occupation of Iberia also lasted for many centuries, and advantage ebbed and flowed between Muslim and Christian forces in southwestern Europe. The Battle of Tours-Poitiers was, however, the point at which the easy Muslim victories ended. Now turning to another critical battle against the Muslim military conquest trying to subdue Western civilization. We now see here on page 82, Kahlenberg, 1683. Breaking a two-month siege, the coalition army of Jan Sobieski, King of Poland, defeated Ottoman forces of Kara Mustafa Pasha, halting their incursion into Central Europe. Now, I'm going to go, the viewers at home can pause it if they want to read the whole story here and look at their screen on a pause. But I'm going to page 2 about this battle. And I'm looking at the first column here and just reading it says, Ottoman threats. Now, Ottoman, those are the Muslims. These are trying to spread Islam. But anyway, it says here, the Ottoman Sultan Mehmet IV, 1642-93, sent a threatening message to Leopold I. It read, quote, primarily, we order you to await us in your resident city of Vienna so that we can decapitate you. We will exterminate you and all your followers. Children and adults will be exposed to the most atrocious tortures before they are put to an end in the most ignominious way imaginable. End quote. Now imagine if you're a king of a city and you get sent a letter like that from the Muslim hordes coming to take over your city and your whole province. Anyway, the Europeans did not waste a 15-month window of opportunity, and Leopold concluded treaties with others threatened by the westward movement of the Ottoman army. And as you can read, there's a lot of statistics, how many men, things like that. What I find fascinating about this battle, and it goes on to the last column here, under cavalry charge. As Sobieski approached Vienna, that's in Austria, so the Muslims are threatening to move right into Europe over there. Mustafa did little to impede his progress, and the troops of the European Confederation reached the high ground at Kahlenberg, or Bald Hill, early on the morning of September the 12th. When Mustafa realized that his enemy was deploying for battle, he attacked but encountered stiff opposition from Austrian troops on his left and the Germans in his center under the command of Duke Charles of Lorraine, 1643-90. Soon he committed a tactical error, attempting to rush the city itself rather than deal with the military force opposing him. Sobieski committed Polish infantry to the contest and gained high ground on his right. While their infantry had been engaged for hours, a large contingent of Polish, Austrian, and German cavalry waited among the neighboring hills. At 5 p.m., Sobieski ordered the largest cavalry charge in history forward. At the head of 20,000 horsemen, Sobieski broke the Ottoman lines. His 3,000 heavy lancers, the famous winged hussars, put the Ottoman troops to flight. The pursuit resulted in the capture of Ottoman supply trains and camps. When the battle was over, 15,000 Ottoman soldiers were dead or wounded. The European coalition had suffered about 4,500 casualties. And it goes on to talk about that. But here the Muslims were turned back in this giant battle. But anyway, this battle sort of reminded me of the second installment of the Lord of the Rings movie trilogy, where the humans were saved from the orc army by a tremendous cavalry charge on their flank, if you remember that. I just wanted to mention in passing from this book, 100 Battles, Decisive Conflicts That Shaped the World. Just a few of the other battles mentioned in this book that had to do with the civilized nation, particularly of Christendom and Islam, the battle of those 548 battles that are mentioned by Bill Warner later in the main presentation, battles with Islam over a 1400-year period. Here's one, Hattin, in the year 1187. Hattin was a great victory for Saladin, who used his faster, lighter forces to impressive effect. He was assisted to a large extent by his enemy, King Guy, who chose to march heavily armored troops through a waterless region at the hottest time of the year. And you can see here from just the pages, and here's an outline of that battle, most of the Christian forces were destroyed by the Muslims, and of those that were taken captive, as number 3 here says, like so many sheep, the Crusader infantry are herded into the Eastern Horn, those who are not cut down or rounded up to be sold into slavery?
Well, here in the West, there's a general atmosphere of ignorance about Islam. People don't know even the most basic facts about Muhammad and the Quran, and this allows Muslim preachers to say whatever they want about Islam because no one's going to correct them. So if a Muslim preacher is talking to a woman who's interested in women's rights, Muhammad was a champion of women's rights. If he's talking to someone who has a high regard for science, the Quran is a scientific masterpiece filled with miraculous scientific insights that were only verified centuries later. If he's talking to someone who's concerned about racial justice, Islam is the religion that liberates slaves and establishes racial equality. Absolute nonsense, but people convert to Islam because they believe what they're told and don't bother reading the Muslim sources to see if the preacher's story checks out. Now, to those of you who've bought this mess, to those of you who believed the Muslim preacher when he said, "Hey, if you really want to stick it to whitey, you need to convert to Islam, the religion of a white man who bought, sold, and traded African slaves and whose followers institutionalized black African slavery centuries before Europeans joined in and who continue enslaving black Africans even today," if you fell for this, I say and I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what these white prophets with black slaves do.
We see that a lot of things that happened in these early battles way back in time where people are sold into slavery and things of that nature. It's the same thing that ISIS does today. So ISIS is very reflective of actual Islam. Here's another battle, Nicopolis from 1396. The final major crusade of the Middle Ages ended in horrendous defeat for the Christians at the hands of the Ottoman army in the Balkans. And as you can see there on the page, there's battle facts and so forth. Here's another, Constantinople, the fall of Constantinople in 1453. Its once impregnable walls breached by Ottoman siege guns brought to an end the Byzantine Empire and established the Ottoman Empire as the major threat to Christendom in the Mediterranean and Eastern Europe for the next two centuries. Of course, the fall of Constantinople was a major blow to the Christian civilization, as the Muslims then converted the city into what is now known as Istanbul. Here's another major battle, Pantipat, 1526, heavily outnumbered. Babur, ruler of Kabul, utilized superior tactics and field artillery to defeat Sultan Ibrahim Khan Lodi and establish the Mughal dynasty in India. And you have a lot of battle information there, as you can see. Here, another major battle, Lepanto in 1571. Before the epic battle of Lepanto, the Ottoman Turkish fleet seemed all but unbeatable. However, developments in armament, along with the tactics to go with them, permitted the Holy League to defeat a superior force of Turkish galleys. Basically, this is once again a battle between the Christians and the Muslims. But in this particular case, it was a tremendous victory for the Christians. And you can see the battle map there. The main reason they won, even though they were outnumbered, is because the Christians had better artillery on their ships, so they could blast the Muslim ships as they came near before the Muslims could hit them with their archers. One thing I'd like to say about these tremendous battles that were going on as the Muslims expanded their empire by military conquest, the same as ISIS tries to do in our modern day.
This is our Khilafa in all its glory, remaining and expanding. It was established in the year 1435 Hijri. Its leader from the tribe of Quraysh is Sheikh Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and its territory is already greater than Britain, 8 times the size of Belgium and 30 times the size of Qatar. It's a state built on the prophetic methodology, striving to follow the Quran and Sunnah. Not a secular state built on man-made laws whose soldiers fight for the interests of Tawhut legislators, liars, fornicators, corporations, and for the freedoms of sodomites. We are men honored with Islam who climbed its peaks to perform jihad, answering the call to unite under one flag. This is the source of our glory, our obedience to our Lord. We are uncompromising in our call to Tawheed. We only bow to Allah. Unlike the countless deviant factions raising their false banners and changing with the winds of Jahili politics. Yes, we are the soldiers who stopped the idols of nationalism, demolished the Shirki symbols of Palmyra and Nineveh, and destroyed the Sykes-Picot borders. For there is no honor to be found in the remnants of Shirk and nationalism, and no difference between an Arab and a non-Arab, or a black man and a white man, except through piety. This is the glory of faith that unites us. Justice is served with the establishment of the Islamic courts, and there are thousands of masajid and schools for our cubs and pearls, where they prepare themselves to share in the great rewards of expanding this khilafah. America, you claim to have the greatest army history has known. You may have the numbers and weapons, but your soldiers lack the will and resolve. Still scarred from their defeats in Afghanistan and Iraq, they return dead or suicidal, with over 6,500 of them killing themselves each year. So while you go around cooking the facts on the results of your military airstrikes, we continue to haunt the minds of your soldiers and sow fear into their hearts, with 18 of your soldiers committing suicide each day before you even advanced. And in addition to the $6 trillion price tag on your war against the Muslims, you're now too weak to put boots on the ground. You opt instead to attack us from the air with missiles, each worth $250,000, while we send your proxies to hell with 50-cent bullets. Then, there's your new coalition of devils, with Iran, Turkey, and Russia joining the fray. That's because the Millah of Kufr will always unite you together to fight the truth. So bring it on, all of you. Your numbers only increase us in faith, and we're counting your banners, which our prophet said would reach 80 in number. And then, the flames of war will finally burn you on the hills of death. Bring it on, for we echo the mighty call of our prophets. Gather your allies, plot against us, and show us no respite. Our ally is the greatest. He is Allah, and all glory belongs to Him.
فأجمعوا أمركم وشركاءكم ثم لا يكن أمركم عليكم غمة.
Here's a picture of one of the two brothers suspected of bombing the Boston Marathon, who was named Tamerlane Sarnef. That means he was named after the 14th century Turkic ruler Tamerlane, also spelled Tamberlane, but more commonly Timur or Timur, who called himself the Sword of Islam. Tamerlane Timur, says Wikipedia, was known for his butchery and his systematic use of terror. His empire stretched thousands of miles, encompassing parts, among other countries, Turkey, India, Iran, Afghanistan, and also Kyrgyzstan, where the Boston suspects were born. Tamerlane was a devout Muslim who referred to himself as the Sword of Islam, converting nearly all the Borjigin leaders to Islam during his lifetime. His armies were exclusively multi-ethnic. During his lifetime, Timur would emerge as the most powerful ruler in the Muslim world after defeating the Mamluks of Egypt and Syria, the emerging Ottoman Empire, and the declining Sultanate of Delhi. Timur had also decisively defeated the Christian Knights Hospitaller at Smyrna. Timur's armies were feared throughout Asia, Africa, and Europe, sizable parts of which were laid to ruin by his campaigns. Scholars estimate that his military campaigns caused the deaths of 17 million people, amounting to about 5% of the world population. Taking advantage of his Turco-Mongolia heritage, Timur frequently used either the Islamic religion or the law and traditions of the Mongol Empire to achieve his military goals or domestic political aims. This shows that Islam is not only religious, but is also political. He not only consolidated his rule at home by the subjugation of his foes, but sought extension of territory by encroachments upon the lands of foreign potentates. His conquests to the west and northwest led him to the lands near the Caspian Sea and to the banks of the Ural and the Volga. His incursion into Persia was notable in part for what Tamerlane ordered his troops to do after the brief siege of the city of Isfahan. When Isfahan surrendered to Timur in 1387, he treated it with relative mercy as he normally did with cities that surrendered. However, after the city revolted against Timur's taxes by killing the tax collectors and some of Timur's soldiers, Timur ordered the massacre of the city's citizens with the death toll reckoned at between 100,000 and 200,000. An eyewitness counted more than 28 towers constructed of about 1,500 heads each. This has been described as a systematic use of terror against towns, an integral element of Tamerlane's strategic element, which he viewed as preventing bloodshed by discouraging resistance. He massacred 100,000 captives at Delhi and at least 20,000 more at Baghdad. The Baghdad death toll came after Timur ordered that every soldier should return with at least two severed human heads to show him. Many warriors were so scared they killed prisoners captured earlier in the campaign just to ensure they had heads to present to Timur. In all, the conquests of Timur are claimed to have caused the deaths of up to 17 million people, an assertion impossible to verify. Timur's campaigns sometimes caused large and permanent demographic changes. Northern Iraq remained predominantly Assyrian Christian until attacked, looted, plundered, and destroyed by Timur, leaving its population decimated by systematic mass slaughter. Timur's devotion to Islam, especially in his waning years, was never in question. But in his earlier adulthood, he seems to have been more of a religious opportunist who just loved to subjugate and plunder. Notes one reviewer of Justin Marazzi's biography, Tamerlane, Sword of Islam, Conqueror of the World. Timur rationalized his conquest by appeal to Islam, but he rates as one of the greatest butchers of Muslims of all time. His forces were hired and kept loyal with generous shares of the spoils of conquest, and the cynical deal was, quote, "No jewels, no jihad," end quote. If a city were rich enough to merit plundering, it would qualify as a city of bad Muslims to be blessed with Timur's corrections and a pretext found. If it happened to be filled with crusaders or Hindus, all the better. The Ottomans themselves, fresh from annihilating the flower of Christian knighthood at Nicopolis, were swept aside almost without effort. Clearly, Timur's blessings to his religion were equivocal. Campaigns against Delhi and Christian enclaves in Asia Minor allowed slightly more convincing pretext of religious war, and in his later years, he directed his energies more consistently against non-Muslims as he felt immortality approach. But his campaigning character seems to have been defined by the lust for conquest. We see here eternal jihad. The reference from the Islamic sources are here. It says, after all the victories, some Muslims said that the days of fighting were over and even began to sell their arms. But Muhammad forbid this, saying, quote, "There shall be no cease from the midst of my people a party engaged in fighting for the truth until the Antichrist appears," end quote. Jihad was recognized as the normal state of affairs. The history lesson you're about to get on Islam is factual and is documented in world history itself. And now for our main presentation.
As I told you on 9/11, I suddenly realized it was my task to make difficult books readable, which is what I've done on the back table. I sometimes describe myself as a man who reads big, thick, old books and writes modern, small books that anyone can understand. And actually, I rather enjoy it. I don't surf the web. People are disappointed when they run into me sometime and some other counter-jihadist, they go, "Have you seen my website?" No. I don't even go to my own website. I have very little interest in the web except for Craigslist and Yahoo headlines and Drudge. That's it. So I like reading big, thick, old books. I really do. But I thought when I got my books written, in which the Quran was easy to understand, here's Muhammad easy to understand, all these books on Sharia and everything were easy to understand, I thought, we win. No, we don't even have game. Because what I discovered was, other than a minority view, and trust me, you are so minor, everyone else's reaction to the knowledge, to the answer to question, what is the true nature of Islam, react in fear, hatred, and anger. When I try to explain to people something about Islam, they're terrified. So I thought people would run when I got my books published, and indeed they did run away from me. So I thought there was just one great question. What is the true nature of Islam? But I found there was a second question more important. Why are we afraid to know Islam? Now, remember I told you about stories? Here's the thing. My books are factual. They work here. But in dealing with human beings, if you're going to make a sale, any salesman will tell you this, the facts are secondary to the feelings. And where you get feelings is from stories, amongst other places. And I began to think about, why is everyone so afraid even though they don't know anything? Well, it turns out they do know little figments of stories about Islam that involve violence. And the knowledge that they were into the slave trade does not come as a shock, really. So remember I told you that the house of Sufism was like a palace with a smell coming up from the basement? Everyone smelled that smell. They just don't want to talk about it. But it's somewhere deep in the back, almost primordial mind. So, the problem is we don't know the history of Islam. We don't know the answer to this question. This is the world of Islam. How did it happen? You can ask very intelligent people, and they will not be able to give you the answer to this question. How did North Africa go from being European and Christian to becoming Arab and Muslim? How did that happen? And is that an important question? How did the Middle East go from being Christian to Muslim? And is that an important question? I think it's an overwhelmingly important question. All right. Now, to understand how that Islamic world came about, we're going to have to go about and see how Islam entered our world. Now, to do that, Islam entered the world of the Byzantine Empire. We know that in the Sira, Muhammad's life, his last days were spent killing Christians and subjugating them. After he died, that process continued. So, let's describe the world that Islam invaded. Now, we are told that the Roman Empire collapsed when the German barbarians invaded Rome. Y'all heard that story? Well, that's false. That is not true. It is wrong. What happened was, after the German barbarian tribes invaded Rome, they set up their own version of the Roman Empire. They retained classical culture. They spoke Roman. They hired Roman philosophers and Roman attorneys to teach their children and to run their schools. They came into the Roman Empire not to destroy the empire, but just to get the goods for themselves. The eastern part of the empire, so-called Byzantine Empire, is over here. Now, this is after the German invasion. The important point is this: there was still a classical empire. It's not collapsed. Then, after the fall of Rome, the Byzantines gradually exerted their political influence till now this was the new form of the Roman Empire. This is the Byzantine Empire, and it is about to be invaded. This is the classical world that Islam invaded. Notice that the classical world is still up and running. It's critical to remember that. It was now weak, but it was still up and running. We're going to see what caused its collapse. Here we see in 25 years, three stages of development of the spread of Islam. This is 25 years' work. How is it that the Arabs were able to do to the Byzantine Empire what the Persians could not do in Iran? Here's the answer to that question. It has to do with Iran, actually. The Greeks and the Persians had been having wars since forever. All right? The 300 at Thalipomy, that was about the Persians. All right? Alexander the Great, he defeated the Persians. The Persians kept hammering on the Romans and then the Byzantines, and 25 years before Islam invaded, there was one massive last series of battles that left Persia weak and the Byzantine Empire very weak. Then comes along the Black Plague. One person in three dies. So the Byzantine Empire, when Islam invaded, had been weakened by a long war with Persia and the loss of a third of its population. The economy had collapsed by two-thirds. You think the Obama economy is bad? Try two-thirds. So we had an empire that was weak, invaded by people with a mission. Now, what's important here is these three different shades of green represent the different caliphs. This empire is beginning to build here came from people who could be described as the apostles of Muhammad. Why is it important to know that? They knew Muhammad. They held his hand. One of them, Ali, married his daughter. Abu Bakr was his father-in-law. These people are not just brothers in the religious sense, they're brothers in the family sense. They knew Muhammad like I know my wife. And what did they do? Did they go out preaching the Quran? No, they didn't. They picked up their swords, got on their camels and horses, and went out whacking Christians and Persians. That is, this is the true nature of Islam. Here you see it. This is the fruit on the tree. Massive destruction. Now notice something else that's happened here. Egypt is the breadbasket of the Mediterranean. Syria, the heart of the intellectual world of the classical empire. In 25 years, the classical civilization lost its ability to feed itself and lost its biggest brain trust. This destroys classical Christianity. Christianity that we have today is a bloody stump of the original Christianity. Why? This destroyed the heart of it, transformed it. The first stage of the annihilation of classical empire. Gone. The heart of it's gone. Okay. A century later, notice over here in Spain, 750 AD, Spain is already Muslim. This is rapid-fire conquest. This is going to become very important because this was not, this happened, as it were, in the life of a nation overnight. This brutal assault is the key as to why we fear Islam. Now then, you're next going to see history that you've not heard before. I'm not a historian, but I am a scientist, and I can reason from data. I knew, once I read the story of Muhammad, that I had been fed a pack of lies about what caused the Dark Ages. Roman barbarians didn't cause the Dark Ages. First off, why would these barbarians were Germans? These are the same people who made Germany. You're telling me they were too stupid to learn how to do Roman law and stuff? Of course not. They were very intelligent people. They didn't cause the collapse. But that's the classical theory. If you go to Vanderbilt, that's what they'll teach you. Here we go with the data. There has recently been a lot of classical ancient works that have been translated and put into a database format so they can be accessed. There's been massive archaeological research under the ocean and at the edge of the Mediterranean. From this archaeological research, we're able to track history and economies. All right? That figure I gave you about how the economy collapsed, that came from the study of sunken vessels. Because if you're not buying much, you know, if one in ten, let's say one in ten ships is sunk, that figure's not that high, but whatever. If you see a lot of sunken ships, there was a lot of ships sailing around. When they go down, the economy goes down. So from this data, we know a lot. And this, in particular, the database of ancient documents gives us 548 battles that Islam fought against the classical world. This is all new information. I've talked with people who are consider themselves history buffs, and they go, well, let's see, battles of Islam against Europe, let's see, we've got the invasion, we got Tours, we got the invasion of Gibraltar, we've got Lepanto, Gates of Vienna, collapse of, okay, that's five. You talk to a historian, and those are the five battles they can scratch up. And I remind you, you can have all of these slides if you just send me an email for it. Okay, what does this new data show us? It shows us this. See the white spots? They're brand new battles. They're going to change to red. These are new. Every time, I want to show you this all over again. Every tick is 20 years. The new battles for that 20-year period come up in white, then they fade to red to show you the history. So white's what's happening right now, red has happened. Let's see how these 548 battles act out over. We're going to watch, in 70 seconds, we're going to watch 1,200 years of conquest. Look how fast this is happening. Bam! Here comes... You didn't know France was hammered that hard, did you? You heard of Tours. Watch what's happening in Spain and the islands. Now, many of these raids or battles, if they're at the coastline, are slave raids. The slaving that took place in here was extensive and went on and on. All of this work is also happening now then. We're now into the golden age of Baghdad. This is the punishment that's being handed out to Christians everywhere. In Spain, after one battle, there were knights' heads were cut off and they made a pile so high that a man on horseback couldn't see over them. All of the European civilization in North Africa is now gone.
I have a question. Have you read the 13th Tribe?
No.
Okay.
Now, pretty soon... And by the way, there will be a period of time, and you can see the clock running up here, there will be a brief blip of five battles that occur in North Africa, the Barbary Pirate Wars. We're on there. Okay? Now then, Byzantium has fallen. Now then, Eastern Europe is being hammered. Notice that it is relentless. It doesn't stop. This is the history that you're never told about. This is the history that explains how all of this came about. Now then, they're getting slower because Islam is becoming weaker. Corruption. All empires collapse from the inside ultimately. Okay. I say that what caused the collapse of classical civilization was not the invading German barbarian tribes. I say that classical civilization was destroyed by Islam. Now comes the question, why do we not want to know that? We're going to answer that question. All right, now I want to give you the headlines. With all those little dots, basically what I've showed you is just quantity. Okay? Relentless, but quantity. Now I'm going to give we gave you 1,200 years of battles in like 70 seconds. Now we're going to go through in about 4 minutes. I'm going to give you the headlines from each century so you will know the emotional tone of what is happening. All right, 7th century. Muhammad sent Khalid out, the sword of Allah, to the Jazima tribe to offer Islam. They refused. He annihilated every one of them. At the Battle of Oasis in Iraq, for 2 days he spent out rounding up the losers, put them in a dry stream bed, and cut off heads until the stream ran with blood. He then took the captain of the Zoroastrian Persian tribe. His wife was there. He cut off the man's head, let the blood drain into the soil, and raped his wife in the bloody soil. That was one of the companions of Muhammad. This is the nature of jihad. Where did Khalid learn how to do that? From Muhammad. From Muhammad at the Battle of Khaybar. Umar conquered Jerusalem, and every Jew and every Christian became a dhimmi, which is a third-class semi-slave. You're now going to see, for the next few centuries, you're going to see Golden Age. We're told this myth of the Golden Age, how wonderful Islam is. So here's what's happening during the Golden Age. They started attacking Sindh, which is the Hindus. 26,000 Hindus died. Armenian nobles were herded into a church after a debate, and the building burned down on top of them. At Ephesus, 7,000 Greeks are enslaved. We're still having the Golden Age. All new churches were ordered destroyed. At Amorium, there was massive enslavement of all the Christians. The Egyptian Christians revolt over the jizya, which is the dhimmi tax under the Sharia. Churches are burned, vineyards destroyed. 10th century, we're still in the Golden Age. In Thessalonica, 22,000 Christians enslaved. Christians massacred in Seville. In Egypt and Syria, 30,000 churches destroyed. You have your religion, I have mine. Still in the Golden Age, 6,000 Jews in Morocco killed, hundreds of Jews in Cordoba killed, 4,000 Jews in Granada killed, Georgia and Armenia invaded, in Hindustan, 15,000 killed, 500,000 enslaved. Golden Age, still upon us. In Yemen, the Jews are given the choice of convert or die, the Christians of Granada are deported to Morocco, and in India, cities are destroyed under the order convert or die. In one town, 20,000 Hindus became slaves. Still the Golden Age. 50,000 Hindu slaves decided to get freedom by converting to Islam. A new 20-year campaign created 400,000 new Muslims out of Hindus. Buddhist monks butchered, nuns raped. In Damascus and Safed, mass murder of Christians. Jews in Marrakesh massacred. Tabriz, forced conversion of Jews. Still, we're in the Golden Age. There are riots in Cairo. Churches are burned. Jews of Tabriz are forced to convert. Tamerlane, one of the most evil men who ever lived, massacred 90,000 Hindus in one day. 30,000 in another battle, massacred in cold blood. Another Muslim leader takes 180,000 Hindu slaves. Oops, we're out of the Golden Age. See if you notice any change in tenor. Tamerlane destroys 700 villages in India. Now then comes he then turned to Iraq and annihilated the Nestorian and Jacobite Christians. The Nestorian Christians, half of the Silk Route in China was Nestorian Christian. The Nestorian Christians had emissaries and missionaries in the court of China. Afghanistan was partly Christian. All right? Gone. This is part of the destruction of the church that no one knows about. 700 years of attack, they finally destroy Constantinople. 16th century, the son of Tamerlane destroys temples, forced conversions. Two of his generals built two towers of human heads. Once again, you couldn't see over them. And then noble women, Hindu women, started the practice of sati, which was mass suicide, in order not to be sex slaves inside of the sultan's harem. 17th century, Jews of Yemen and Persia forced to convert, forced conversions of Greeks. The Zoroastrians are persecuted in Persia, and over 500,000 killed Hindus. 18th century, more Zoroastrian persecution, Jews of Jeddah expelled, Jews of Morocco massacred, Hindu persecution continues. 19th century, more forced conversion of Jews, Jews of Baghdad massacred, 250,000 Armenian Christians slaughtered in Turkey. Now then, in Persia, the Zoroastrians are completely annihilated. 20th century, over 1,000,000 Armenian Christians killed. 1,000,000. So you now not only know the number of battles, you now see the tenor of what's going on. You now know quality and quantity. Do you get the drift on how bad this was? Now then, the establishment doctrine is that we've already told you classical collapse had nothing to do with Islam. And indeed, Islam was a source of good, because the hillbilly Europeans lost their classical learning and the shrewd, smart Arab Muslims preserved all the knowledge in the Golden Age. This is what is taught in our schools. I maintain that it was annihilated by Islam. Okay, we've been talking about land here. I now want to talk about water, because classical civilization was based upon the Mediterranean Sea. Egypt was part of the Mediterranean world. It was not part of the African world, okay? Because to go from Alexandria, Egypt, to Nigeria was a lifetime. But you could get on a ship and be there in 10 days. Does this make sense? It was cheap transportation. You could haul a ton of grain from Egypt to Rome as much as it cost 75 miles by ox cart. This is important. I'm going to be driving back on the interstate after I finish talking here. I do not expect to be attacked or shot at on the way. I presume that the interstate is safe travel. It used to be that way under the Roman peace. That ended. The importance of naval work, as many as 500 boats could be in the harbor of Constantinople. The collapse of the freedom of sea. Let me show you something. Now, we know this from history, the data. Rome used to communicate with France by boat. After Islam, they went overland through the Alps. Why did they do that? There was no longer freedom of the sea. Here's interesting. The Black Plague was a known problem in the Mediterranean. It used to take 4 months to get from here to Constantinople because there was sea trade back and forth. Well, that was eliminated. So now then, when there was an outbreak of the Black Plague, it went from harbor to harbor, harbor all around here, and it took 4 years to get to here. Do you see the point I'm making? There was that little freedom of trade. As a merchant striking out to do business, you could wind up with your ship gone, your goods gone, and you're in chains, enslaved. By the way, this cuts down a lot on commerce. A brag. The Christians couldn't float a plank on the inland sea. What did this do? It isolated Europe and impoverished Europe. So, you know the business of the Barbary pirates? You know the business of the Somali pirates?
Same, same.
Same, same. It is Sunnah. It is Sunnah, the way of Muhammad. There's a famous hadith which is repeated endlessly in which Muhammad awakes in a dream and he sees his jihadists sailing the inland sea. Islam always practices, where possible, economic warfare. Muhammad attacked caravans. What was attacked in New York? Ooh, Trade Center. This, economic warfare. I am an admirer of Islamic civilizational war methods. They're superior to everyone else's thinking in war. They use everything for war. Everything, including the womb. This was an economic jihad. There were three, you've heard of the Dark Ages? Well, there were three Dark Ages. One in Europe, one in Turkey, one in North Africa. You weren't told that, were you? I wonder why. Here we see some ruins. What's the importance of these ruins? Well, they're up and standing. What happened to all the ruins in Rome? Well, the people who were still living there used them as quarries. They harvested them. The Colosseum remained simply because it was so big. What does this tell us here? If all this stone is still stacked up, there were no people. The invasion of North Africa was so brutal and so fast that it actually left in the harbor a layer of silt. Here's how that happened. North Africa used to be farmland, irrigated farmland. The Romans, clever men that they were, put along the roads in North Africa olive trees for shade and for keeping the road fixed for free. Because what would happen is you would bid on buying a lease on a stretch of Roman road in North Africa. You maintain the olive trees and the road, and you got to keep the olives. So the Romans got money from selling the lease, and then they got the road fixed for free, and somebody has a business making money. Is this clever or what? That all ended because the invading Arabs were not farmers. They were herdsmen. The people there were Christian. And so therefore, when the goat, the average Arab family would own 50 goats. They put their goats out into the fields of Christians, and the Christians as dhimmis had no right to protest. Between death and the erosion of the crops, there was this produced a layer of silt in the harbors. So that's how brutal, hard, and fast came about this collapse of economy in North Africa. What was left for European economy? Furs, lumber, swords, and slaves. We're now really getting to one of the points where we don't want to know this history. Anybody here all real proud about how some of your ancestors were taken off a coast in Italy and then put into a harem in North Africa? And now you have children from that who are distant relations? You see, you may have distant relations in the Arab world you don't know about because 1 million Christians were sold into slavery. And by the way, the Venetians helped to do that. And another embarrassing piece of news is this. The Jews were very big in the trans-Mediterranean slave trade. Nobody comes out of this looking good. No one looks good. Are you also beginning to see, like, I don't think I want to know any more about this history at all? Okay? Are you catching on here? All right. Now, the other thing we're told that's so bad about Christianity and so pitiful about those poor Muslims are the Crusades. Who's ever heard this? Well, the Crusades, oh, that's so embarrassing. Gosh, you know, we got out of Europe, we went over there and invaded the Arab lands, and then we killed them and hurt them, and like, oh, I've heard preachers wallow in pity about how drastically bad the Crusades were. All right, first off, Islam, remember, destroyed 30,000 churches. The Jews and Christians were dhimmis. There was infinite number of brutality against Christians. Christians were fleeing the Middle East, and the Byzantine Emperor appealed to the Pope, help us, please. Now, this was a big thing to do because the Byzantine Emperor and the Pope did not get along at all. But these were desperate people. And what did the Pope look out and see? This is the world that he saw in 1100, the time of the First Crusade. Well, let's see. This much of Spain is Muslim, and we're getting our behind kicked on a regular basis. Oh, well, this Christianity's gone. Oops, this Christianity's gone. And look at all the battles in the non-Christian, in the areas of, that are still Christian. Do you see the geopolitical problem that the Pope was facing here? This was not just some, you know, we'll saddle up, get on our horses, and go steal from them Arabs, which is what you're told. This is the political picture. But now then, let's do this. Let's look at a battle map for the Crusades. Let's be fair. I showed you the jihad map. Now here comes the Crusade battle map. We're almost done. That's it. Now we're told that the Crusades are the moral equivalent of jihad, and therefore we need to be ashamed and whine and cry. All right. The Crusades were defensive, lasted 300 years, and the last one was over 800 years ago. All the jihad was offensive, lasted 1,400 years, and it's happening right now. In all probability, some Christian is being slaughtered in Nigeria today. Now, is this moral equivalence? Why won't they teach this in a church school? So the ministers will stop, oh, the Crusades were just so terrible. No, the Crusades were one of the few times the church put steel in its spine. And then we apologize for it. Now then, let's go to the great benefits of Islam. We're told about two different golden ages. We're told about Andalus, the wonderful empire in Spain, in which there was multicultural peace. And Jew and Christian and Muslim all lived together in a golden age in Europe. You ever heard that? Well, here we go. This is the battle map of the Golden Age in Andalus. Now, while all this is going on, orders for slaves are being filled. The first slave order out of Spain was the Caliph ordered up 3,000 blonde virgins. They were shipped out of Spain. Battles are going on in which Christian knights die. But notice something here. The Christians won't quit fighting. This is going to take 700 years, and there's going to be nearly 150 battles fought.
Where was this caliph located?
There was more than one caliph at the time. This was a caliph in North Africa.
Okay.
Now then, looking at this, do you understand why when Isabel and Ferdinand were finally in full power, they told every Muslim in Spain to get out of here. They drove everyone out. Okay, my question for you is this. Was Andalus a multicultural golden age or a reign of terror? I claim it was a reign of terror, and it was not a golden age at all. And yes, there were a few people who had it good. The elites had it good. There were some rich Jews and rich Christians that had it good. Also, otherwise, there was constant war, slavery, and Christians had to wear robes so you could tell a Christian from a block away. And a Christian couldn't carry a sword, and they paid special taxes. And then we come to the question, why are we told this story? Now we have the Baghdad Golden Age. Here we go. This is all the battles that are fought during the period of the Golden Age in Baghdad. Now, not only are they as busy as they can be killing Christians, but they're also busy establishing the Sharia doctrine. They're also busy establishing the Hadith doctrine. And they're also busy in doing things like slave trading. You know all those exotic photo pictures you've seen of the harem? They're sort of pre-Playboy sexy, beautiful women in gauzy outfits. All of those women were Christians. Less romantic sounding, isn't it? The other thing that's happening in Baghdad is this. A new philosophy is being generated in which there is no cause and no effect. This turns out to paralyze the mind. Okay, those were all the battles that were fought during the mythical Golden Age. Okay. During the Golden Age, Christians and Jews were dhimmis, Christians were sex slaves. Here's one that gets me. During this Baghdad Golden Age, they evolved a philosophy in which there were no laws of nature and there was no cause and effect. I'm a scientist. We work off of two laws, the law of contradiction, does the data contradict the data, and the law of cause and effect. I've just explained to you why, out of their golden age, why you don't find Muslims getting Nobel Prizes in science. You cannot be a scientist and not believe in cause and effect. You just can't. Won't work. Now then, the Christians did all of the vaunted translation of the Golden Age text, and get this. We're told that this was such a great peak of learning, they destroyed 90% of the books. And we're told that the remaining 10% they preserved is like, oh, this was the Golden Age. Oh, we live in eternal gratitude to the Muslims. If they had come along, we'd have had 100% of them. Presented with a library in India, the largest library in the world was a Buddhist library in Nalanda. They came to him and reported the existence after they had conquered, and they said, what shall we do with the library? The order from the general was this. If it contains any information that is in the Quran, we already have it, burn it. And if it contains any information that is not in the Quran, it is false, burn it. The same was done with most all of the libraries. And why are we told this was some wonderful golden age that preserved knowledge for us? Ottoman Empire, 1683. The reason I have this up here, Islam in Europe. That's the world today. I've now explained to you how this world came about. It came about through relentless, brutal persecution of everyone who was not a Muslim. Now then, let's change to modern times. All of that work stops in 1922. This works off a database of 19,000 jihad attacks since 9/11. There are things like this. I know the date, the country, the city, how many are killed, how many injured, and a description. Now, when you present a guy like me with 19,000 pieces of data, I start asking questions, how do we make this make sense? So let's make it make sense. By the way, you did hear all about these 19,000 attacks in the Tennessee and in the local newspaper, didn't you? You did hear about this. It was on the nightly news.
We heard about Fort Hood.
Oh. The workplace incident. Oh, yeah, I got that. All right. Anyway, moving along here. This, by the way, is where all these took place. And you think that's interesting. And you'll notice something. This is the Islamic world, and it all centers around it. But notice how much is happening in Europe. Okay. I take the data, and I parse it, and I divide it. I use Islamic doctrine to analyze this data. What does Islam insist on? Well, in my first lecture, I told you they're fixated on the kafir, right? So I use the kafir to analyze this data from an Islamic standpoint. See, I'm the ultimate multiculturalist. No, really. I'm the only person you've ever met who analyzes Islam on the basis of Islam. Here we go. Here we have, in the last 10 years, the total number of attacks. In the green, we have Muslim-on-Muslim violence. You mean a Muslim will kill a Muslim? Really? They're doing it in Syria as we speak, right? Remember Iran, Iraq? Okay. Then we have the only one I care about. I mean, my motto here is sell weapons and intelligence to the loser. I'm very serious. You think I'm joking. Okay, here's our story right here. Stays pretty level. That's interesting. By the way, there's hardly a day in which there's not a jihad attack. Modern jihad is relentless, just like classical. Oh, by the way, one of the things this curve proves right here, Islam is bad for kafirs, Islam is bad for Muslims. Islam is bad for Muslim and non-Muslim. That's what this data shows us. You want to argue with that? Okay, modern jihad is relentless, but what did we see in the other battle map? It was relentless. There are two types of jihad, against the kafir and against Muslim. You see, every time they kill a Muslim, the reason in Syria they're killing other Muslims, they're not real Muslims. Okay? Now then, we've introduced, however, a new phenomena, the mom-and-pop non-state jihadi shop. Okay? All of those battles up to 1922 were out of the caliph. Okay? We now have non-state jihad. That is all that is different. Okay, jihad attacks per year, I just chose the top four nations. But this doesn't really give us what we want because Israel's teeny-weeny and India's great big, so let's do this on per capita. Now then, Israel, I bet you were surprised about Thailand. You didn't know that Thailand was getting whacked on a regular basis, did you? And look, here's a Christian nation, the Philippines, ranks number three. And in India was Hindu. Oops, wait a minute. Do you know what I just told you? Jihad is against the Jew, the Buddhist, the Christian, and the Hindu. This is the data. Now you go to these dialogues, these multicultural schmoozes they have, where the preacher and the rabbi and the imam show up. The preacher and the rabbi show up to tie. The Muslim shows up to win. And then what does the Muslim tell them? Oh, the Christians and the Jews, they're people of the book. Oh, we're brothers in the religion of Abraham with the Christian and the Jew. You know, we're practically the same. We're brothers in Abraham. How's that stuff work out? Well, here's one of your people of the book. Here's another people of the book. Turns out they'll kill a Jew, a Buddhist, a Christian, or a Hindu just as fast as they will another. So much for being brothers in the religion of Abraham. The data does not support the theory. Therefore, the theory is wrong. There is no brotherhood of Abraham except in the minds of people who occupy pulpits. The jihad is against the Jew, the Buddhist, the Christian, the Hindu, and the secularist, by the way. The secularists are the worst of all. Well, maybe worse than the Hindu. It's hard to know, you know, I mean, really. It's against all kafirs. That's who the jihad is against. The religion of peace. Here we go. 548 battles, 19,000 jihad attacks. In 12 decades, in 1,400 years, that are jihad-free. Therefore, Islam is 91% violence and 9% peace. So George Bush was 9% right when he declared religion of peace. Constant violence is why? There's a doctrine. The doctrine of jihad is found in the Sirah, the Quran, and the Hadith. We've already been over this. They don't like kafirs. We have a whole doctrine of jihad within the text. Islam was only successful through jihad. Therefore, we have a doctrine which produces jihad, and it produces this effect of the collapse of civilizations. Here you go. Tears of jihad. 270 million dead over 1,400 years. Read them and weep. Read them and weep. The doctrine drives history. History shows the true nature of political Islam. Political Islam is the enemy of all kafir nations. There's an intellectual history. In 1,400 years, I've read a lot of old documents. They never talk about the Muslim. They talk about the Arab, the Turk, the Moor, Al-Qaeda, Asian. And it's always been by specialist. And today, all the established specialists are apologists for Islam. Why was the Quran code not cracked in recently? How come we don't teach Muhammad? And why is the Golden Age propaganda taught? Why do we remain ignorant and keep suffering? I maintain there's a reason for this. I maintain that this constant brutality over the centuries has produced in the Western mind the equivalent of the abused dog, the beaten wife, and the raped child. We do not think correctly. Everybody's seen the beaten dog that when you approach it? That is the Western mind. We deny the attacks. How much jihad is ever reported? The churches will not even admit that a Christian suffers anywhere. Fear. Muhammad used fear. Any public critic of Islam has a certain fear element there. Guilt. Oh, we haven't treated Islam right. If we treated them better, everything would be good. We don't teach the history. We humiliated. Who here is going to go home and brag about how your ancestors were slaves, how your history was annihilated, and that all we teach is the lie of the Golden Age? Have you not noticed since 9/11 how bitter and angry politics has gotten? The reason is we're not allowed to get angry at the enemy, so we get cranky with each other. We're powerless. Anybody want to debate about this? The abuser. Muslims will not admit they sold a single slave or ever killed a person. They're arrogant and self-confident. Islam is perfect. Where Islam means submit, they expect submission out of us, and they get it. Islam is the victim. After 9/11, I heard this. The real victims of 9/11 were the Muslims. You heard that anywhere? After 1,400 years of jihad, brutality, enslavement, theft, deception, rape, annihilation, and insults, the Kafir mind has become identical to that of an abused victim. Our only solution is to face our history and welcome it and embrace it. This is exactly the way we will heal our nation is the way we heal a person who's been brutalized. You have to go back to the original event. And this is why we are afraid. Thank you.
Thank you for watching this video. The doctrine of Islam is more concerned with unbelievers than believers. 64% of the Quran is devoted to how to treat a kafir. The life of Muhammad, the sirah of Muhammad, is 81% against kafirs. That's unbelievers. The hadiths of Islam, the authoritative hadiths, is 37% against kafirs. The bulk of Islamic doctrine is political, not religious. Medinian Quran, which is the last part of the Quran, which is written at the latter part of Muhammad's life. Remember, the 13 years when Muhammad first started were spent in Mecca, where he preached for 13 years and only got about 150 followers. But after he was run out of town, and he spent the last 9 years of his life in Medina, well, he changed his doctrine. Then he started teaching jihad, which is military conquest of the unbelievers in war. And that's where his religion or political ideology really took form and shape. Instead of only getting 150 followers in 13 years, he got tens of thousands of followers because as they captured caravans, attacked villages and cities, captured the women, made them sex slaves, took all the money. Well, he started getting more and more followers because he only asked for 10% of the take. He gave the other 90% of the sex slaves and money to his followers. So with everybody getting all these spoils, well, he suddenly got all these new followers that he never had when he first started out the 13 years there in Mecca. Well, anyway, that's why the bulk of Islamic doctrine is political, not religious. So when you get the part of Quran that was written later, not the first part, which is written early, which doesn't mention anything about jihad in the Quran. The part where he was in Medina, which is part of the Quran, that's where he comes up with jihad against unbelievers. And 24% of that part of the Quran is calling for jihad against the kafirs, the unbeliever. The life or biography of Muhammad is 67% jihad against unbelievers. And the hadith, 21% jihad against the unbelievers. For more information about all this, and it's easy to see why Islam did not really have success until Muhammad incorporated the doctrine of jihad, military conquest, and violence against unbelievers, and taking their possessions, making them dhimmis, which are like a third-class slave under the Islamic Sharia law. For documentation concerning the history of Islam, please go to Dr. Bill Warner's website, www.politicalislam.com. Please notice the books that are available there for further research, such as The Foundations of Islam, Muhammad and the Unbelievers, The Political Traditions of Muhammad, An Abridged Quran, A Two-Hour Quran, The Life of Muhammad, The Hadith, Sharia Law for Non-Muslims, The Islamic Doctrine of Women, The Islamic Doctrine of Christians and Jews, The Doctrine of Slavery. On the subject of jihad in the Islamic Hadiths, that subject of jihad comes up 21% of the time. So if you combine the three main sources of Islam, the Quran, the life of Muhammad, the sirah of Muhammad, and the Islamic Hadith, you find that 31% of these three sources of Islam comprise jihad against all unbelievers, basically war against unbelievers. It's also interesting to note that Jew hatred is mentioned throughout Islamic sources. And if you add up from the main three sources of Islam, the Quran, the Hadith, and the life of Muhammad, you find that Jew hatred composes 9% of those Islamic sources. 9%. Now, when you contrast that with Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, if you take the Jew hatred that Hitler mentions in his book, Mein Kampf, you find that it only comprises 7% of Hitler's book. But when you look at the Islamic sources on Jew hatred, 9%. So the Muslim sources outdo Hitler when it comes to hatred of the Jews.
Check out our websites, BibleQuery.org. This site answers 7,700 Bible questions. HistoryCart.com. This site reveals early church history and doctrine, proving Roman Catholicism is not historically or doctrinally viable. MuslimHope.com. This site is a classic refutation of Islam, a counterfeit religion created by Muhammad. Free newsletters are also available.
Hello, this is Larry Wessels with just a quick message to our viewers to check out our main YouTube channel, See Answers TV, which stands for Christian Answers Television, where we have all of our over 610 videos posted. By going there, you can see all of our videos organized by playlist, categorized by subjects. Once you scroll down past our Bible prophecy trailer at the top of the channel page, the playlist begin. You'll see our recent uploads playlist, followed by our most popular videos playlist, followed by our playlist on Jehovah's Witnesses, then Islam, the Muslim religion, then Roman Catholicism, Darwin's metaphysical evolution religion, Seventh-day Adventism, dealing with anti-Trinitarians and early church history, our multiple playlists, which includes God-hating atheists, phony TV preachers and King James onlyists, dealing with UFOs, ghosts, spiritual warfare, our radio shows with national Christian authors and our music biz, the Black Muslims, Louis Farrakhan, and the Nation of Islam, Mormonism, hell, lake of fire, unpopular Bible doctrines, Antichrist, cults, New Age, and world religions. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, Jonathan Edwards, and Spanish videos, end times, supernatural prophecies, and tough Bible questions, and our playlist dealing with predestination, Arminianism, and Calvinism. Our YouTube channel is built to help people learn the Bible and defend their Christian faith against false prophets that come against it from every side, Jude verses 3 and 4. At the time of this recording, our channel has already been blessed with over 6 million viewings and over 10,000 subscribers.